Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the KE Report Weekend Show. Corey and Shad, your hosts for this weekend show. On this weekend show, we're going to be going around the horn talking markets and metals with one of our favorite, more generalist traders. And then in the second half of the show, reviewing a new book that came out from a regular guest on our show focused on the gold and silver markets. Another busy, kind of choppy week for markets. Metals continue to do quite well. And look, there still seems to be a lot of opportunities to make money out there. You just need to be in the right sectors with the right momentum. We are kicking off the show with Rick Bensinger, president of Bensinger Investment Strategies. Rick writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. That is read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail and individual side, something that I'm sure a lot of you, our listeners, are more interested in, check out Rick's In the Know Trader website. I'll post a link to that website. Rick has three products, one being the 7-Eleven Ultra. This is where he constructs a portfolio like a hedge fund would build. So instead of paying those hedge fund fees, you get this for less than $100 a month. And on the shorter term time frames, he has a weekly report called the Tactical Trader Report and a daily report called the Daily Tip Sheet. Rick, I want to start off with a broad comment on the markets. We talk to a lot of people day after day, week over week, and I've gotten such a mixed, I guess, narrative from our guests on the breadth of the markets. We hear from some people that breadth was widening out in the last few weeks, but then we've also heard that breadth is actually concentrated. We heard that tech was lagging the markets, but then we also had people this week saying that tech has now become another leader in the markets. Rick, can you make sense of what's happening under the hood of these broad averages for us, please?
Well, thanks for having me, Corey and Chad. What I'll tell you, probably right off the bat, is the people making the comments about which way breadth is going and which is going up and what's going are generally, in my belief, this is people talking their book and trying to find data to support what they're hoping happens. You can look at breadth, you know, depends on which breadth you're talking about. Is it New York Stock Exchange breadth? Is it S&P 500 breadth? You can always play with statistics to make them be what you want. So first off is know the source. One of the things people know from my 40-plus year career on Wall Street as a commodities pit trader, as Morgan Stanley's chief strategist for many years, as someone who consults to some of the top hedge funds of the world now for many years, is I tell you what I think. It doesn't matter about what prior calls I've made, what I'd like to see happen. I'm generally the first guy who's going to tell you, no, maybe that wasn't, you know, what I said 2 weeks ago or 2 months ago. It's not playing out. You need to look at this or that. I think when you talk about breadth widening, sure, Mag 7 is not leading the charge higher now. And there's an ETF, MAGS. You can look at collectively how the Mag 7 are doing. And, you know, it's topped out. It's not materially off its highs. But at the same time, it's not what's particularly leading the market higher right now either. So it topped in early December, not far from the December 6th high that hit Spider's 609, which had been, I mean, you have me on your show every month. How many months have I talked about, you know, 609 in the S&P as being the upside target for this move? I think last summer I was already telling you that way before it ever got there. If you include today, between Spider 608 and 610, you now have the fourth high in 2 months at that same level. And we're either going to ultimately break out from this multiple tops at this level. And if we do, we probably surge higher and start a whole new leg up. On the downside, what's been obvious the last few, let's see, I'm trying to think the first time. Well, since the August 5th low, which was a major low that bottomed on a large gap down on news out of Japan, every subsequent low has been higher. So for those of you who are technically oriented, you have higher lows and equal highs. That's a classic ascending triangle. You're either going to break to the downside and retest the bottom of the range, or you're going to explode to the upside. And I think it probably happens fairly soon. I was thinking possibly today's employment report could have been the catalyst for which way we really, you know, ultimately go over the next several weeks and possibly months. It didn't materially move the market itself. And even though the S&P is down some, I don't know, 40 points while we speak, a lot of it has to do with a typical Friday option expiration and the fact that, you know, Amazon's trading down and Max Evans not, you know, rallying today. There's, you know, there's a few things that are putting a little pressure on the market, but it's also only a little past noon Eastern time, which means we've got almost 4 hours to go. And the way things have been going recently, you could be down 40 points in the S&P and close higher on the day. You know, volatility, even though it's not showing up at the VIX, intraday volatility is very high. We move 20, 30, 40 S&P points like nothing these days. So with spiders at 602.5, you're still in striking distance of, I'm not saying today, but you're in striking distance of, you know, breaking out above the 609, 610 level and starting a whole new leg higher. Or we possibly hold here again and come back down to 575-ish, which was, you know, the January low.
Yeah, Rick, we've seen a lot of that intraday volatility. So who knows how it's going to break, but we are getting near that tipping point that you just outlined. I guess another comment we've heard a lot this week and even last week, Rick, is that things like the equal weighted indexes are starting to perform better. And so the takeaway some people had was that, hey, maybe there's more participation. I know that you look at things through the vantage point of individual equities, but also through ETFs, and you manage which ETFs are outperforming, which ones have relative strength. Underneath the market internals, are you seeing any sectors that are changing up the batting order as far as how you're looking at which ones are getting the best relative strength?
Well, look, you've got the Mag 7 names span three ETFs, XLK, XLC, and XLY. So the K is technology, C is communication services, that's Google and Meta, and XLY is Tesla and Amazon. And in all three, XLK, XLY, XLC, those Mag 7 names that make up the top names of those ETFs generally represent at least 40% of the entire ETF. So you're still talking about these names being the dominant reason any particular ETF outperforms or underperforms is how these Mag 7 names are trading within those ETFs. If I look right now, just broadly, equal-weighted S&P versus, you know, cap-weighted S&P, you have a potential double bottom from last July's lows to December's lows, but the bounce has been so minimal, too early to really call it a double bottom. It's, you know, you got two kind of equal levels. And if you pull up a, you know, you create a ratio chart of RSP, which is the ETF that's equal weighted S&P versus spiders. So you're not really truly seeing breadth widening out yet. You can understand why people are saying it's happening, but the reality is when you actually look at the ratios, is it's not happening very much.
So, Rick, where is money concentrating? Is money concentrating in a more bullish, aggressive, growth-focused manner? Is money finding safe havens right now, or is this kind of a balanced market?
I think it's somewhat balanced. Over recent months, you are seeing some non-mega-cap names certainly get bids. You're also seeing, instead of like Mag 7, think of, I don't know what name you want to call it, but like the next 25 stocks in the S&P, let's just say the top 30 names, you're seeing much more bidding going into some of these. They're still large cap and they're still at the cream of the crop of all 500 names that make up the large cap index, the S&P 500. But you're seeing some more interest in names that aren't, quote, officially the Mag 7 names, but still very large cap names. So it's good to see it broaden out a way that, you know, retail is not only buying the seven names that make up the Mag 7. And look, you've got Salesforce and Broadcom and let me think what other things that are popping up that I'm thinking of. Look at what Palantir has done. And they're not even on a large part of the cap scale yet. But that's a stock that has, doubled in, four months or something? I mean, it's incredible. And I'm honestly bummed out because I had some resting orders to buy it on the pullback in January. Well, when it's trading at its all-time high back then, I put in a bid in the 62 handle. And we got to the 63-something was the low of the January sell-off. And now it's, $112 stock, something like that. So you are getting a broadening out of names that are outside Mag 7, but it's not necessarily extending way out beyond still the top tier of the large cap. It's just not necessarily in Mag 7 itself. Uber has bounced nicely. S&P 500 name got whacked, got down to, 60, or after being maybe an 80-something high, got into the low 60s, and now it's $75 stock. So there is some decent opportunities. Finding them is, challenging. Do you buy the dips or not? So far, buying the dips generally has worked. But take a prior shining star like Regeneron, and that was an $1,100 stock that's trading, $600-$700? If you don't get the right names, it can be very painful. And that's the challenge. That is truly the challenge of playing a market like this. So I can't tell you specifically right now which sector, because honestly, there's so little that you can figure out of which is going to be the next hot sector. Generally, you can. But right now, for the last month, I've been telling clients, we look at a chart, there's an indicator, and it's not part of most charting systems. I know it's on the Bloomberg, which is a professional charting platform. It is, I believe, in stock charts, if you're a subscriber to stockcharts.com. It's called the relative rotation graph. And you can put the 11 major S&P economic sectors, energy, financials, consumer discretionary, staples, et cetera, the 11 sectors up, and kind of watch how they rotate in a clockwise fashion of what's going to be the leading, what is leading, what's falling from leading, and what's the worst. And it is almost for last month, there's nothing that shows up as being the next outperformer, which is, some of the sectors have to outperform. There are 11 sectors. Some of them have to outperform. And normally we can kind of get a sense of what's going to come next. And in this case, there is no clue on what's going to come next to be, where to put money to put in, whether it's XLF, XLI, XLK, where you want to put your money next to get the next move up. It is very hard to determine. And I think it's why you're seeing the market so choppy and kind of in a trading range that we've been in for a couple months now.
Well, Rick, since we've talked last, we've had a lot of narratives that have kind of come to an end or at a decision point. At the end of last year, the second, third, and fourth quarters, you heard things about AI stocks, quantum stocks, space stocks. There was a lot of different narratives running. Then it got into electricity and even things like Constellation, the largest utility, was acting like a meme stock. So we had the big DeepSeek situation come up since we've talked last. We saw some pressure in AI stocks in the semiconductor sector. NVIDIA got whacked. We saw it hit energy. We saw it hit uranium and nuclear stocks. Now the dust has settled for the last couple of weeks. Any takeaways from that period of time where we saw the shakeup in tech and energy?
I think it shows you that investors are desperate to be in whatever is deemed to be the next hot thing. And if you came late to the game in quantum names, you got your rear end handed to you. A $20 stock became $10 overnight, and it still hasn't much recovered. The trader's market right now, when you get into somewhat of a sideways pattern like we've seen, you got to buy low and sell high. And of course, in theory, that's what we've all been taught. Anybody in the market, some point, somebody in your life told you buy low, sell high. A lot of investors do the exact opposite. They buy something, it ends up being near the high, and they hold and they hold, and when they finally sell out, it's the bottom end of the range. and they sell to other people who are willing to take the risk at the bottom of the range to ultimately try to sell it towards the top end of the range. I think that's how you have to think about the markets now, not get married to names. And until we get a clear breakout that we're actually going to go higher here without another pullback, it's dangerous buying strength. And you need a name that really has momentum behind it to work if you're going to buy strength. Because otherwise, what you're really buying is where smart money is selling. And that's the last thing anyone really wants to do. But it's what so much of the public does do when they're paying attention to headlines and what people on TV tell them to do. I mean, look, honestly, most of the people who are the talking heads on these business television stations are talking their own books. And some sound like really smart people and very likable people. But the reality is they're there talking their own book and doing what's best for them. And they realize they have a platform. So when they say something, it goes out to lots of people and they hope other people jump on board. But they are no smarter or dumber than any one of your listeners. They're just other, you know, they're people who are lucky enough to have a platform to get that information out. And it doesn't mean that they have even once outperformed the market in the last 20 years.
Oh, Rick, it just ties all back into what you're saying initially is just understand people are always talking their book. So understand where that narrative is coming from. Let's filter down to the metals sector, because that sector, the precious metals, have been doing quite well. Gold, very strong this year. Even GDX, the gold miners ETF, that's up almost 20% just this year. So a month and a week of trading. What's your outlook for, let's just start with gold right now.
All right, so I had lightened up gold exposure months ago near 2,700 at long-term upside targets. And it worked in the sense that you got close to, I think, a 10% pullback, where I made my mistake, even like in my own account, was not buying on the buy signals that I had on the bottom to get back in. And part of that is just I'm doing so many things, you know, so often. And sometimes I'm like the shoemaker who doesn't have shoes for himself, but I make sure my clients are good. When I look at the bigger picture now, it would suggest that you'd still want to be a buyer on pullbacks. In this case, I'd say initially almost every $100, there's something on the chart. But if I had to think of where's the right one now, I don't know. I'd say if it pulls back to 2,700 from almost 2,900 where we are now, I'd probably be a buyer again and replace what I had sold out of. I don't have a particular number. I know people on the street were saying gold 3,000 this year, and that's certainly very possible with it at close to 2,900. But that's just a big round number. There's nothing, I don't see anything specifically at 3,000 that makes it anything special per se.
What about the gold equities, Rick? Because they have lagged the move in gold over the last year or two, but have started having a better 2025, doing a little catch up. When you look at an ETF like GDX or GDXJ, any takeaways?
Yeah, so we're long GDX in, I think it's the weekly Tactical Trader report. And we're back now on the chart itself, and I'm sorry, on a relative chart to, let's say, long GDX, short GLD. That's worked beautifully since essentially January 1st this year. You're up straight from there. But right now, you're kind of very close to where it all broke down from. It was at least three bottoms from last summer into last fall, all around a ratio of something like, I don't know, call it 0.155, which means like the price of GDX is 15.5% of the price of GLD. And that's how you read ratio charts, is you divide, you know, what you want to be long by what you want to be short. And this has brought it, right now we're right back to, up against some resistance of where this broke down from. So would I put on long GDX, short GLD right now in here? No, I wouldn't. It's a trade that for a long time people have tried to properly call the big turn, because as you say, for years, gold equities have way underperformed the price of gold itself. And for here and now, I'd say it's not the right time to do it. And I'm not sure where it is in the bigger picture. Let me just see if while we're talking here, I'll just take a quick look at them, like medium term chart. All right, so it does have a double bottom from January of 24 to pretty much December of 25, equal lows on that, and we're moving up, but we haven't broken above the downtrend yet. We're in the middle of the W of that potential double bottom. Just too early to say. It's something I watch with some frequency because I'd love to be able to perfectly time that, you know, entry into when you could finally buy gold equities relative to bullion itself. And it might have been on that, you know, December low, but for now you're still dealing with overhead selling and a general downtrend, a multi-year downtrend in that ratio. So we'll see, but I wouldn't put it on right here and now.
Rick, what is this gold trade all about? We hear a lot of people who, again, are kind of talking their book, but they are saying this is kind of like the 70s, or they point back to a couple of times in history where gold went 6, 7, 8x its price. And in all fairness, if we go back 10 years, gold has gone pretty much 3x its price when it bottomed back in 2015 at just over $1,000. What's going on in the gold market and the markets fundamentally that are pushing people into gold?
I think a lot of it comes down to inflation that really has not been dealt with on a more permanent basis. There's just always inflation. And you know, over the last several years, obviously, the U.S. had very high inflation. The Fed's done everything they can to get back to their 2% target, which I think is a probably unrealistic target. I think 2.5% would be much a smarter target for Jay Powell to kind of concentrate on. It's the long-term devaluation also of just buying power. You know, since, I don't know, about 2000 or so, so in roughly 25 years, gold has done just as well as the equity market has. And there's not a lot of periods of time where you can go that, you know, 25 years and say, gee, gold has done as well as buying equities. It really has become, it's a combination of, you know, supply constraints. Look at the difference between gold and silver. Silver in the low 30s is, let's call it, I don't know, I'm not sure where it is today, but let's just say it's around 32 bucks, give or take. It might be a dollar more or less, but somewhere around there. So if the all-time high in silver is 50 bucks and it's trading 32, that's 18. So that's 36% beneath its all-time high. It's not like gold, silver is more industrially demanded. It's that there's so much more of it. And gold has always just been the instrument used as what theoretically backs currencies. But go back to before there were currencies, go back, you know, 1,000 years and 2,000 years, gold coins were the, let's call it, currency of choice and what had the most value. You can't chew gold. You can't, you know, you can't make bread out of it. It's not like it has utilitarian service that way. So this is one of those, let's call it, instruments that has its value based upon supply, demand, and the perceived value of what it is and what it means. And the fact now that if you want to buy yourself a gold chain, it's ridiculously expensive. And if it's only going higher, like if you don't own one, you're not likely going to own one in life because, you know, the price has just become extraordinarily high for something to wear around your neck. I think it's the long-term devaluation of currencies and, you know, the dollar. And even though the dollar looks strong against other ones, it's the loss of buying power over time that is why gold is worth what it is, why to some degree Bitcoin, which also a very limited supply, ultimately limited supply instrument, has the values they do, and why both of them theoretically can go up over time. Obviously, Bitcoin far more volatile, but if there is some real value to using Bitcoin as an exchange for goods and services at some point in the future, and you have limited and dwindling supply over time, devaluation of the dollar over time because of inflation never seems to go away, it automatically makes these instruments worth more money.
Yeah, solid points, Rick. Gold hasn't changed. It's on the elemental table. It's just a rock. But the reason it went from 35 to 2,900 is because of the devaluation and the purchasing power of the dollar. You brought up Bitcoin, same kind of thing. It's a scarcity factor. There's a limited supply. There's the perceived value people have in it. How are you looking at Bitcoin? It's had one heck of a move at the end of last year. It's rolled over a little bit recently. Any concerns with the recent rollover, or is it setting up for the next blast higher?
Well, I think if the stock market makes its next leg up, then Bitcoin will likely follow. It's traded very much in line with stocks, not day by day, but you've got, what is it, a double top near 109,000, you know, whatever the all-time highs are. I look at the futures markets for Bitcoin. So your all-time high was made a few weeks ago at 110 and change, and the prior high was 109 and change, something like that. So you've got a double top that kind of lines up with the few tops that we've had in the S&P and Spiders at 609. It's in a trading range. It's holding $90,000 on the bottom, and let's call it $108,000 to $110,000 on top. It's kind of smack in the middle of it right now. And it may need one shakeout down to the low 80s. And once it gets there, it's probably a buy again. But in here, this is all, again, range trading that you have to recognize it for what it is. And right now, until this thing breaks out higher, it's just, it's in an approximate $20,000 trading range. Again, on a percentage basis, far more volatile than the trading range that we see in the stock market. But it's kind of like right now, a risk on, risk off type asset. And when people think the market's going up there and we're towards the bottom end of the range, they're willing to buy Bitcoin. And as we get, you know, north of $105,000, there's sellers ready and waiting. And the algos play this stuff too now. So they're going to play the range until it doesn't work. And right now it's working. And, you know, most of the algos are cleaning up. There's a lot of the public's losing money over the last few months trying to trade.
Very interesting comments, Rick. Always enjoyable having you on the show. Again, Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies. Click that link in the show notes to visit the In The Know Trader website, or simply search In The Know Trader, and you can find all of Rick's products for the retail and individual investor. Great having you on the show, Rick. Thanks for taking time with us on this weekend show. We'll chat with you next month.
Thanks so much, guys. Appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.